This is a brand new podcast called Heartland Musings on Life, Spirituality, and the Great Adventure of the Soul. I'm Rachel Otwell, and I report on arts and culture for NPR Illinois. I'm joined now by Kyle Isham. He co-hosts a YouTube show called The Studio Show, where Springfield area artists and musicians are showcased, as well as other creative endeavors. But Kyle is also someone who is deeply spiritual and has lots of interesting experiences leading him to where he is now. Hi, Kyle.
Hello, Rachel.
Thanks for being my co-host.
I'm so excited.
We can talk a little bit about how this podcast came to be.
So Rachel and I actually met because I was on her show, The Scene, talking about the studio show. But as soon as I saw her, I knew that this is someone special. She has a deeper spiritual connection that I think a lot of people have, but is maybe not as consciously recognized, because this very word spiritual has been taken out of context, I feel it. For a lot of people, they think of it as something either a kind of borrowed Eastern religion, such as Hinduism or Buddhism, or it's something associated with kind of New Agey practices. And maybe they don't feel comfortable in either of those camps, so then they kind of take themselves out of the dialogue. As human beings, we all confront the same issues. We need to find ways to be peaceful, to be happy, to confront the mysteries of our life, and ultimately to be able to be at peace with our own passing and the passing of those we love and care about.
And so we kind of got talking about tarot when you were here.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of how we made that connection. For me, I'm somebody who was raised to learn about lots of different spiritualities and religions. I went to the Abraham Lincoln Unitarian Universalist Congregation, long name there, but that's in Springfield. And my religious education, for instance, would take on a different religion every year. So one year it was Christianity, one year it was Taoism. So I've always been really interested in that sort of education, but I've kind of fallen out of regularly attending church, so to speak, or anything like that. So for me, this podcast will be a great way to talk to other people about where they've been inspired to be spiritual people, and hopefully start to cultivate that again in my own life. Kyle, I know for you, though, you've had some very intense things happen in your life. You want to talk a little bit about kind of how you found yourself in India, for instance?
Yeah, I think what happens oftentimes when someone undertakes any sort of journey, what precipitates it is a kind of inner crisis. There's something that rises up from our own unconscious side that can often be very disruptive. And I think this is why we see a lot of panic, anxiety, stress, and even physical symptoms that happen that may not have a directly physiological cause. There could be something also connected to that, something deeper from within. And so for myself, in my early 20s, I had a lot of panic and anxiety. And I knew I never wanted to take medicine for that. And I had this inner feeling that there was something that I myself was participating in that made this happen. I may not exactly understand what I was doing to create that, but I could just feel that somehow within me was both the cause and the cure. And so it led me on this great and amazing and incredible spiritual adventure. And so part of that then led me to India when I was in my mid-20s. And so I went there and I had less than $100. I had a return ticket. I ran out of money. And I really was confronted with the deepest fears of my life, kind of a sort of existential crisis of just how would I stay alive and be able to use that return ticket to get back to the United States. And it was amazing. It made me confront things that I never would have had an opportunity to access otherwise. Ever since then, it's radically transformed me. It's made me see I have a reserve of strength inside, and that this life has a kind of grounded magic to it, that if you trust in yourself and in the world, there's a possibility for the unexpected to come through. That is the real secret to really opening up one's greatest creative potential, surrendering to the unknown.
And so a big part of what we want this podcast to be is talking to all sorts of different people about what spirituality means to them and how it intersects with and affects their everyday life. So on today's show, we have two very different interviews. One is with someone who is a fixture in the Springfield area's sort of spiritual community. She founded and now runs Trailhead Healing Arts Center. She has a very moving story on what led her on that journey, so that's coming right up. And then we also spoke with an author and a reverend who is known all over the world for his dissenting views of religion and the Christian and Catholic faith systems, yet he still chooses to be a part of it and has a strong faith and belief in God. He's someone who has inspired many people to think more inclusively when it comes to religious practices and tenets.
But first, we would like to start with our theme for today, spirituality versus religion, the places they intersect and where they diverge.
Right. So this will probably be an issue that comes up over and over again for us. And it's kind of that cliche you hear people say, you know, I'm spiritual, I'm just not religious. So we kind of want to deconstruct the word spirituality and get to what that means and what it means in practice for people. I know, Kyle, for you, that's something that you've come to pretty good terms with. You have your own ways of practicing spirituality. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, and then we'll get to our first interview?
For me, the word spirituality connects to the term psyche or soul. And by this, I don't mean something which is in transmigration from life to life. I mean by soul that part of our own being which has a conscious side that we're aware of. This is our everyday mind that is able to perceive the world around us. And then we have an unconscious side. And this is everything that comes out in our dreams, or sometimes we have these brief moments of intuition. And so these parts, that which is visible and that which is invisible, are kind of always in this dialogue. And sometimes when we aren't aware of that, something subconscious can arise. And that's where there's a conflict between these two parts. And so for me, spirituality is a way to bring integration between the known and the unknown parts of our being, because out of that unknown side is all of our greatest wisdom, I feel. For me, no one needs a teacher. No one needs to be guided per se. They just need a chance to reacclimate themselves to this language of the soul, which is a language we have become very unfamiliar with in our modern times.
And so personally, I'm someone who's gone through life mostly agnostic, you know, in my angsty teen years, probably swayed more to the side of just all out atheist. But there's, you know, that part of me that's still curious and wanting to learn. And as we mentioned earlier, tarot is a tool that I find is helpful just for self-reflection, whether or not you believe it has any sort of mystical powers or anything like that. For me, it's like a meditation. It's a time to take a few minutes to really just step back and think about how things have been going in my life and focus maybe on one aspect of that. And then astrology is something I'm interested in, you know, but even that has such a, both these things have such huge stigmas around them. Yet I know for you, Kyle, they're both things that you find useful in your own spiritual practice.
Tarot and astrology, these are very grounded, practical, on the earth aspects. It's a wisdom that we can access and actually improve our daily lives. It's not something far away and removed and esoteric. The tarot and both astrology use themes or archetypes from our own soul. And so these are energetic patterns which exist inside of us. And when we come to understand them better, we aren't blindsided by them, because so much of the conflict of our daily lives exists by these sort of unseen elements suddenly bursting into play. In a lot of ways, it's like walking around with a blindfold on. And if you suddenly, without any warning, have a blindfold over your eyes and you're driving, that's going to cause a lot of trouble. And so it is all very grounded. And I really stress that whenever I work with clients individually or talk to groups, that it isn't something to take you out of life. It's to enable you to live the most beautiful, joyful, and a life of celebration. That's really the essence of what spirituality is for me. And not only can you celebrate, But then you have the capacity to genuinely give back to others and to your community. And that community accent is so important because, like you said earlier, people say, well, I'm spiritual, not religious. But then their spirituality has no accent on the community. It's just another way to be self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. And that helps no one.
So speaking of making spirituality something that is community-based, our first interview today is with Justina Schott, and she runs Trailhead Healing Arts Center in the Springfield area, in Springfield. And it's very much a community that you're part of, Kyle, and a place where you can get a massage or do some yoga. Lots of different things happen there. But the beginning of this interview, she's talking about how she found yoga and how that led to other spiritual expressions in her life.
My husband committed suicide in 2003. And what happened was I decided to deal with my grief by exercising a lot. Mm. So it was kind of a self-torture process that I went into. I was doing aerobics 3 hours a day. I think just trying to drive the pain out in some way. I did that for a long time in at the Y here in town, and then the yoga teacher at the Y quit, and they asked me to teach the class. And I had never taught anything before in my life, so I started studying yoga.
And had you done yoga prior to this, or?
Just at the Y for fitness, that's it. Wow. I liked the stretching, and it was fun. But yeah, they asked me to teach it, I guess because I had been in the class the longest. I'm not really sure. But once I started studying the science of it, the philosophy of it, that's when I started really getting connected. And then I went to Namaste Yoga Center for my 200-hour training, Himalayan Institute for my 500-hour training. And it was there that I really connected with Swami Rama. He was, you know, dead by that time, but I really felt an intense connection to him and his wisdom that I still have. While I was at the Himalayan Institute for my second 10-day visit, I heard about Ayurveda. And so I came home and Googled Ayurveda in Illinois and found my teacher, Pat Layton. She had her own Bhavana Ayurveda in LaGrange, Illinois. And she's also a student of Swami Rama. She's initiated by him in the 70s.
Can you talk a little bit more about who he was?
He founded the Himalayan Institute in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. And he, like I said, I've never met him in the person, but I've read a lot of his books and just feel connected to him. He seems to bring a practicality to these sciences that I love and I really respond to.
Was he American originally?
No, Indian. Indian. Mm-hmm. And you can read all about his life and living with the Himalayan masters, things like that. He had a very interesting life and talked about all these special powers that yogis can gain through techniques, the siddhis, which is kind of interesting to read about. But that's what I love about these sciences. There's a practicality, but there's also this intense spirituality, and they just weave together beautifully. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about Ayurveda. It's so simple. The techniques are so simple. Not always easy, but simple. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can transform yourself.
So it's interesting, though, that this path kind of just found you.
Yes. Yeah. Thrown into the fire.
Yeah.
And it's still that way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of days, I'm an introverted person. For me to get up in front of a class and teach in itself is a huge struggle, still to this day sometimes, because I would be happy just to sit in my room and read and write all day. That's what I feel like I would love to do, but clearly the universe has other plans for me.
Yeah, could you talk about that? How much do you feel like was just thrust upon you versus, you know, a kind of fate versus something that you actively went out and sought to bring into your life?
Well, I think it's now a combination of both because I have a hard time teaching. I think I heard recently that public speaking, that's the number one fear people have. I mean, more than death. It's a huge thing. But now I love to learn. I am still studying these subjects. I study with an Ayurvedic teacher in California and continue to study with the Himalaya Institute. I am just, you know, after this information all the time. And not just the information. It's not that. It's connection.
This is Heartland Podcast, where we're speaking with Justina Schott. Now we will continue with her as she talks further on the differences and intersections of spirituality and religion in her own life.
One of the aspects that I think is important is, you know, looking beyond yourself in that way, you know, to establish a faith in the divine.
And it sounds like for you, there's been sort of picking and choosing what appeals to you or
exactly,
makes sense to you.
Exactly. For me, spirituality is different from religion. I was raised Catholic. I still attend a Catholic church. I find a lot of inspiration from the priest in my parish, so I continue to go and still love it. But I am also very connected to Hinduism and also some other faith systems that I find inspiration from. Alice Walker has a famous quote that whatever God I found in church, I brought in there with me. So that's the philosophy I live by. So whatever helps me to connect to my highest self.
So I guess what would you say to someone who, you know, is secular, dismisses religion, maybe when they hear the word spirituality, there's stigma attached to that, but maybe listening to something like this would pique their interest. Where do you start?
Well, I can tell you it's come up quite a bit in my Ayurvedic consultations that I do, because I think that's what happens. People, for one reason or another, lose faith in the organized religions that are available to us. Either they don't feel a connection there, they don't feel a personal connection, they don't have any kind of inspiration to be there in church every week, and there's this spiritual void, I guess, that people are in. They just don't know what to do. And one of the things that I have people do immediately is find something that's inspirational to them, an icon of a deity, a rock, something from nature, anything like that. Put it in a special place in their home. And then, so every time you walk by that, you're inspired. It creates a certain feeling to you, in you, a connection with your own sense of the divine. That, to me, that's what spirituality is. And so that's where I have them start. Otherwise, if you feel personally responsible for everything that goes on in your life, you will drive yourself mad. That's where stress comes in. Mm-hmm. If we can't surrender to a divine, we just go crazy in our, you know, trying to control everything.
And so what place do you see a community having in your own development and as far as Trailhead's development?
That has been one of my biggest inspirations, is to create a community. I think I love making connections with people, and I love learning from other people. That's one of the first things I did was change our yoga teacher training program so it's integrative. So I bring even yoga teachers who have come through my program, they all teach a different way. They all have different gifts and qualities that they bring to this practice, and I love seeing those. It's so inspirational to me, and I learn so much from all of them. That's been one of my greatest inspirations, is just to create this beautiful, vibrant community where we can network and work together and build a greater sense of spirituality and connectedness in this community.
So again, that was Justina Schott, who runs the Trailhead Healing Arts Center in Springfield. I'm Rachel Otwell, and I'm joined by Kyle Isham, and we are co-hosts of the new podcast that you are listening to right now called Heartland. Coming up, we're going to talk with someone who's been called a maverick Episcopal bishop. He's a fan of God, religion though, not so much. We're going to give you a taste of what he has to say here in an interview that he recorded with TVO, which is an educational public channel in Ontario, Canada.
We've reached a point in our history where Christianity, if it's going to survive, has got to transcend the boundaries of religion, because religion has become very negative. When religion makes the news in my country, it has to do with priests abusing children or lawsuits. It has to do with bashing homosexual people. It has to do with male institutions trying to prescribe to women how they might properly use their bodies or morally use their bodies vis-a-vis birth control or abortion. And the idea that religion has devolved into being concerned only about those issues, all of which are sexual issues about which the Christian church knows very little, I think is a tragedy. I don't want to be identified with that.
So that was the Reverend John Shelby Spong. Kyle and I did an interview with him that you'll be hearing shortly. But Kyle, the theme today is very broad. We're talking about the differences between spirituality and religion. And we thought that it might be a good idea to kind of break down some themes that will frequently arise in the show. You kind of talked about your idea of the soul already, but do you want to talk about that again?
Yeah, especially as it connects to the conscious and unconscious. In our daily lives, there's always this interplay between what is visible and seen and known by our own mind and that which is kind of rising up from this place of mystery inside of us. And so while I feel very grounded and earthed and have that practical side to my spiritual experiences and expressions, there's always this meeting with the unknown. It's that part that we don't know what our lives will turn into. Even several months ago, I would have never perceived doing this show, yet it's something that arose, and it was something that then that intuitive side knew immediately that this is where I need to be. This is something I need to be doing.
And like Justina was talking about having her spiritual board of directors, and in her case, she even goes to a Catholic church regularly. But for you, do you see yourself as kind of putting together that hodgepodge almost, taking pieces? Or do you have a name to what you relate to spiritually?
I think spiritually we're at a really fascinating moment. And not only spiritually, just the entire consciousness of humankind, that something new needs to come in. We've kind of been borrowing traditions from several thousands of years. And not that there's anything wrong, but there always needs to be new myths that come into a culture that kind of reinfuse it and give it a new vitality and expression. The world we live in is so radically different from anything that could have ever been imagined when these traditions were first forming. And this is really, I think, the key and most important thing for me, that it's not something that is just done at this certain time or that certain time, or on Sundays I go here, or at this time at night I completely isolate myself and then everything is good and peaceful and okay. What is truly spiritual needs to be integrated into the whole of one's life, so that even in the midst of a stressful situation or a painful situation, you know that you have the confidence and the ability to meet that, and to meet it with integrity and beauty and courage, and to also do that playfully and joyfully, so that it's not something overly serious and burdened and this kind of weight around your neck. It always needs to retain that element of joy and spontaneity.
And so now we're going to hear from Reverend John Shelby Spong. He is widely regarded around the world as a progressive Christian author and lecturer, I would say. He talks a lot about equality and is a proponent for civil rights for gay people, for instance. He was in Springfield talking at the Abraham Lincoln Unitarian Universalist Congregation. And he was a bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Newark for 24 years, and he retired almost 15 years ago, about 15 years ago. And so he's written several books. As we found out, a certain book on homosexuality is what kind of was his big break, I guess.
Yeah, it thrust him into the public spotlight.
And so he's considered a champion when it comes to inclusivity in the Christian faith. And so we talk to him more, and we start by asking him about the theme of today's show, which is what he thinks the difference is between spirituality and religion.
It's hard to define because people use both words in such a mixed up way. Some people, when they talk about spirituality, sound absolutely like lunatics. And some people who use religion, particularly in a political manner, use it in such a way it becomes idolatry. So the two terms are pretty squishy.
I think both of them reflect the human search for that which is ultimate. And the route that you travel in that search aims in the same direction, but the route that you travel can be very varied. I did some studies years ago and conducted dialogues with a Buddhist scholar in China, with Hindu scholars in India, and with a rabbi. I've never had a real significant dialogue with a Muslim scholar. But the fascinating thing about all of those was that I discovered that the questions that every faith tradition asks are almost identical. I mean, what is life about? What is its meaning? What is our destiny? Who are we? Why are we here? The answers we give are where the divergences come in, because the answers come in out of the culture in which you ask those questions. In the Far East, for example, there are millions and millions of people, and they don't have this sense of individuality that we have in the West. And so the religions of the East tend to be religions of the masses, and they don't focus on individuality, so that Nirvana, for example, is sinking into the great sea of God without any individuality, particularly. And in the West, it's always resurrection of the body of the individual. So that the differences in the religions of the world and in the spiritual quest is more in the way we are acculturated in responding to the meaning of life, and not in the questions are almost always the same. I find that sort of fascinating.
Could you talk about the quote that you said, the Bible is about life, not about religion?
The Jews don't even have a word for religion, which is interesting. The Jews wrote the Bible. Religion is an aspect of life. If you were a Jew, the sense of God and the Torah governed all of life. It wasn't an aspect of life, it was all of life. And it wasn't until sort of after the Middle Ages that religion became an activity of life. In the Middle Ages, it was right interesting because the only theater in town was the church. They didn't have theaters, so the only plays that you saw were in church. They were all miracle plays and morality plays. And so all the people of the village or of the countryside would come in for the play. The women wouldn't come because they weren't allowed to go out at night. So it was always a male audience. Even the players, the men, males played all the female parts. But after the play was over, these people in the sanctuaries of the churches would take their stein of beer and drink it to the glory of God. And nobody thought that was sacrilegious because life was one whole thing. But if you want to see the difference between that world and this world, go into Jerry Falwell's church in Lynchburg, Virginia, and drink a beer to the glory of God before the Bible, and they would run you out. You know, it's a very different. Religion is not an activity of life, and it's not the center of life, the whole of life. And I think that it's a sort of foreign word to the Christian story. The Christian story basically is about enhancing the life of everyone who is alive. Jesus states his purpose in the fourth gospel as clearly as it's stated anywhere in the New Testament. I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly. It has nothing to do with religion. It has everything to do with living fully.
What was your process like stepping away from the modern religious tenets that you were brought up with? I know you had talked some about the kind of homophobia that was indoctrinated.
I was raised in an evangelical Episcopal church in Charlotte, North Carolina, where the Bible was thought of as the dictated word of God. And in that church, I was taught that segregation was the will of God, and the Bible was quoted to prove it. I was taught that men were by nature superior to women, and the Bible was quoted to prove it. I was taught that it was okay to hate other religions, and especially the Jews, and the Bible was quoted to prove it. And I was taught that homosexuals were either mentally sick or morally depraved. Mentally sick was the liberal position, morally depraved was the conservative position. And of course, the Bible was quoted to prove it. And I had to walk out from under all four of those prejudices to come. I suspect I would have left Christianity altogether if I had not been able to escape that early indoctrination. And I look back at the history of Christianity, and I'm not proud. Anti-Semitism comes right out of Christianity. We gave that prejudice to the world. The Crusades of the 11th, 12th, and 13th century were basically anti-Muslim. They went out to kill the infidels, and the infidels were all Muslims. The civil rights movement was the first thing that gripped me both emotionally and intellectually. And I was just a young man. I remember when the march from Selma was conducted by Dr. King, I might have been 26, and I was a brand new ordained priest serving in a rural community in eastern North Carolina. And, you know, I didn't go down and march with him at Selma. I probably didn't have the courage to do that at that moment. But I wanted to identify with it, and I remember I chose as the opening hymn for our service that morning, "Lead on, O King Eternal," and I thought that was so clever, but not a soul got it. Not a soul saw the relationship between Dr. King and my King in the hymn. So it was an ineffective witness. But it wasn't long before the issue was drawn, the segregation issue was drawn in my community, because the court ordered the desegregation of our schools, and so you had to stand up at that point. And that's when I began to say, if you don't stand up, then you'll never stand for anything. And it was not comfortable. I got named public enemy number one by the Ku Klux Klan, which was sort of fascinating. I had night riders calling me at all hours of the night, 2 and 3 and 4 in the morning, to tell me that my daughters would be raped by the biggest, blackest, and they would use the N-word. And my daughters at that point were 6, 3, and 1. We used to walk my oldest daughter to school and meet her at school every day and walk her home. It's only 4 blocks away in that little town. But we did that because that's the only safety net we could throw around her. It was a fascinating experience, and you learn to deal with being hated. But you also learn something about integrity, and that was sort of the beginning. Then I was the father of 3 daughters, and I wasn't the father of just ordinary daughters. I suppose no father thinks his daughters are ordinary. But my daughters today are senior vice president at Wells Fargo, the staff attorney to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and a PhD in physics in a high-tech company in California. And they're all women who have crashed the boundaries and pushed them away. And you don't raise that kind of daughters and then have people say, but women can't be priests. It doesn't make any sense. So I began to move toward equality of women in every area of the church's life and in every area of the society's life. And we won that battle. And today my church has, I'd guess, 30% of our bishops are women, probably close to 50% of our clergy are women. The presiding bishop of my church, the number one office in my church, was a woman until about a year ago. She served an 8-year term and then retired. Now we have an African American as the number one person. So my church has sort of gone past those barriers, and I think I've been a force in it. When I was elected bishop in 1976, it was the first time I'd actually moved much out of the South. And the homosexual issue wasn't even on the radar screen for me. It just was not something I thought about. I don't know that I define gay people any differently from the way I'd been taught all my life, and that's gay people were deviant, and if they were sick, you felt sorry for them and tried to cure them, and if they were depraved, you were quite judgmental and you tried to convert them. If they didn't get converted, it was okay to beat them up, which we did right regularly, and even kill them if their name was Matthew Shepard in Wyoming. And I moved to New Jersey, and for the first time in my life, I confronted a community of gay and lesbian people who weren't ashamed to be gay and lesbian. They were really open about it, and they celebrated it. It was a brand new experience. And after 2 or 3 difficult experiences where it became obvious that I didn't know anything about sexual orientation, I contacted a doctor whom I had met at the Cornell School of Medicine in New York City. His name was Robert Lajita. And I said, Bob, I don't believe I can be an effective bishop if I don't understand sexual orientation. Would you and the doctors at Cornell be willing to take on a bishop and teach him? Well, they had never had a bishop before. They wanted to learn. So they thought that was an interesting idea. So I worked with them for about 6 months, became absolutely convinced by their studies and all their papers and research that nobody chooses their sexual orientation. It's something you simply awaken to. And that seemed right. I didn't choose to be heterosexual. I tell people I just woke up when I was 12 or 13 and girls suddenly didn't seem obnoxious to me any longer. And so I began to comb my hair and take baths more frequently and do all sorts of things like that. And that was the beginning. And then when my mind got convinced that homosexuality is not abnormal, it's just a minority. Redheads are a minority. Left-handed people are a minority. They're not abnormal. And that was a brand new breakthrough. Well, you can't tolerate discrimination against gay and lesbian people if it's something they are and not something they choose to do. If somebody told me early in my life that I would be the point guard for the homosexual revolution in the Episcopal Church. I would not have believed them, but that's what in fact turned out. And so I began to do some studies, and my diocese began to come out in favor of, we called them gay unions in those days because we didn't use the word marriage. That was back in the early 80s, but that's what we were talking about. And a Methodist publishing house in Nashville, Tennessee, Abingdon Press, called me. I'd written two or three books by that time. They called me and they said, would you be interested in writing a book for us on changing patterns in human sexual behavior? I had a contract with HarperCollins that was exclusive, so I had to call Harper and say, would you mind if I write a book for one of your competitors? And they said, no, that my books didn't sell well enough for them to care. And so I wrote this book. It was called Living in Sin, A Bishop Rethinks Human Sexuality. About 6 weeks before it was supposed to be published by Abingdon Press, they canceled it. And I was actually shocked. They had come to me and asked me to write it. They had actually paid me to write it by that time. And then they canceled it. About 6 weeks, the print was already set. The cover's already printed. They canceled it. And I said, what are you doing that for? And he said, because we've had such a negative reaction from Texas. Well, you get a lot of reactions from Texas. That they had decided that they could not afford to publish it. It was too controversial. Well, I thought that was the end of that book, and I really was distraught because I'd worked right hard on that. I'd had a fairly short time frame to get the book out. We'd planned a book tour. I'd never done a book tour before, so it was all, and it sort of went down the drain, and I thought it was just bad news, but I didn't understand that to be banned by the Methodist Publishing House was almost as good as being banned in Boston, because a story went out across the country that said, Episcopal Bishop's book on sex banned by the Methodist Church. That's priceless advertisement. And within a week, I had 8 or 9 publishing houses bidding for the rights to publish the book. Yeah. So I called my friends at Harper, and I said, well, you all weren't very interested in doing this book before. Are you interested? They were one of the people bidding, and I don't know how to play that game. So I said, you know, you've been fair with me before. You take the book. They did. It sold more copies in 6 months than everything I'd written put together sold in its full lifetime. And I was suddenly in a different league. You know, I was on every television show from Oprah to Donahue to Good Morning America to Bill O'Reilly to...
One thing that will probably always be controversial about you to some religious people is the fact that you don't think the Bible should be interpreted literally.
Yeah, neither did the people who wrote it. If you were Jewish, and that's the theme of my latest book, if you were Jewish and read the New Testament, it would never occur to you to literalize it. The Bible says that if children are willfully disobedient, they are to be put to death. How many people think that's the word of God? The Bible says if you worship a false god, you ought to be executed. How many people think that's the word of God? Who's going to tell you who the true God is? Is it going to be the Pope? Is it going to be the Ayatollah? Is it going to be Ian Paisley? Is it going to be Pat Robertson? No matter who tells you who the true God is, somebody's going to get put to death. Everybody believed that we were created perfect and fell into sin. But nobody's believed that intellectually since Charles Darwin. We didn't get created perfect. Life started as a single cell and evolved through hundreds of millions and billions of years to be what we are.
In one interview, I heard you say about God being treated as a verb versus a noun.
I think that human beings are obsessed with having to define God, and no human being can do that. We think that God's a noun that we have to define, and so we spend a lot of time writing creeds and building dogmas and doctrines to make sure we've got God right. But I think God's a verb. It's interesting that when Moses was given the name of God at the burning bush in the book of Exodus, the name was, I am that I am, or I will be what I will be. It was the verb to be in some form. And I think that's a better insight into the nature of God. I think of God, and, well, let me say it this way. I don't believe I can define God. I don't believe anybody can do that. I believe I can experience God. And what I define is my experience, and that's very different from who God is, because I might be crazy. You know, there are a lot of crazy people in this world that talk about God as if God called them on the telephone and gave them the divine message. I've had people write me and say, God spoke to me last night and said I should kill you. I told them I thought God ought to speak to me directly about that instead of through them. You see, I think God is a verb that you live. I think God is life calling me to live. I think God is love calling me to love. I think God is being calling me to be all that I can be. And I think the mission of the Christian church is to assist to build a world where everybody can love wastefully and live fully and be all that they can be. And that's a very powerful message that I still think has relevance.
So how would you suggest that people, no matter their religion or lack thereof, become more compassionate and cooperative and the goal of building a global community, which you've talked
about? Well, we start with what we have in common, and that is we're human beings. Human beings are the only fully self-conscious animal in the world, which means that we're not bound like other animals. Time flows through other animals. Human beings sort of live in time, and we celebrate our past. Being self-conscious opens you to a whole new dimension of reality. And that part of that reality is what I call God. When you read Carl Jung, and he tells you that human life is linked by what he calls the collective unconscious, you get a sense that we do share in eternity. That is, this collective unconscious that I access today is here long before I was and be here long after I, but I'm part of it. And so those are the places where I go look for hints at human immortality. And when I wrote a book entitled Eternal Life, A New Vision, I struggle to show that you can make a case for eternal life without it being a place of reward and punishment, a heaven and hell. You know, if you're a good boy, you get a party, and if you're a bad boy, you get colds, or sort of like Santa Claus, you know. Most of the God talk that I run into in the church is really very immature, childlike. And so I think if we'd get rid of thinking of God as a noun and begin to live God as a verb. I think of God as mystery, and I think of God as life and always changing. I think of God as love, and I think of God as being, and I want to share in that God. And the only way I know how to do that is by living and loving and being. And there's not much room in that kind of life for prejudice against people of color or women or homosexual people or Chinese people or Buddhist or any other group that we want to single out.
So that was, again, Reverend John Shelby Spong. He travels lecturing around the country and world, talking about the different books that he's written and his kind of unique take on the Christian faith. He spoke in Springfield at the Abraham Lincoln Unitarian Universalist Congregation, and he was kind enough to grant Kyle and I an interview before that. And so we're going to end the show today with a bit of
music, poetry performance.
Yeah, with a poetry performance. Kyle, do you want to tell us more about it?
This is a dear friend of mine. Her name is Ari Honavar, and we met at the Omega Institute in upstate New York about 12 years ago. And so she translated this poem by Rumi from Farsi into English. And so there will be a Farsi translation and then some English as well. And then accompanying her on guitar is Carlos Velasco. And they both currently are in San Diego, California.
Oh. gift you with silence. Hama zindegi hastin za khamoosh nafiri. Die, die in this love, and in this silence, you merge with the heartbeat of the unknown. Bemirid, 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 dar in eshq, bemirid.
You've been listening to the Heartland Podcast, where we consider various aspects of spiritual life here in the Central Illinois area and abroad. I'm Rachel Otwell, reporter for NPR Illinois, and I've been joined by Kyle Isham. He has been studying spirituality, the language of the soul, dreams, symbology, world religion, lots of things that he's going to get more into, but he's been doing that for several years, over 15 years, in fact. So thanks for listening.
Thank you.